So this is Chloe Wardropper. Today is November 3rd, 2016, and I'm a graduate student at UW-Madison. I'm interviewing Dylan Jenkins, and we are at the 2016 SAF National Convention in Madison, Wisconsin at the Monona Terrace Convention Center. This interview is sponsored by the Society of American Foresters and the University of Wisconsin Oral History Program and is part of the SAF Oral History Project. So can you say your name and spell your last name, please?
Sure. Dylan Jenkins. It's J-E-N-K-I-N-S.
All right. I'm just going to turn this up one. So, Dylan, to start off, can you tell me about your career as a forester, just a bit about what jobs you have and how you got started?
Yeah, sure. I've been fortunate. I think a lot of folks that are in forestry think that they're fortunate, and I'm one of those. But I've had a pretty diverse career. I'm a mid-career professional now in my late 40s. I started out in academia. I did my undergrad at Clemson and then Virginia Tech, and really got more interested in, the softer side of forestry, more the human dimensions and social side. But forest economics, obviously I like to be out in the woods, but I got involved with sort of the fringy part of forestry. And my career, even though it was not at all intentional, I've been a bit of a salesman in the hard stuff, and by that I mean forest carbon conservation easements, forest certification. That's really what my career is focused on. Again, not really with any intention. I started out after I got my master's degree in forest management and econ from Virginia Tech. SF forest certification was really getting underway. That was in 1996. So both SFI and FSC had really just launched. And at the time, and they were both trying to figure out what they were, how they were going to position themselves in the market. So in Virginia, SFI actually funded half of my position. The other half was funded through Virginia Tech Extension, and I was an extension forester, and asked to put together a statewide forest landowner education program. And certainly there was already things going on, but it was not very well coordinated. So under the SFI State Implementation Committee, or SIC, and Virginia Tech came together to fund this position. And it was actually a really good thing that it was funded that way, because a lot of times, if all the funding comes from one source, there tends to be, it gets compartmentalized, and by design, happy accident maybe, everybody had buy-in immediately into this position. Unfortunately for me, I had 20 bosses. It's like all the members of the SIC and Virginia Tech and the Virginia Department of Forestry and Game and Inland Fisheries, but we muddled through and made it and really developed what's grown into a pretty amazing program in the Southeast for private forest landowner education. So I was on the ground floor of that. It was exciting because I was able to put it together. Kind of out of whole cloth. So that was my first position in academia. And then while I was there, though, I got interested in land use planning. I helped start a land trust in Southwest Virginia, the New River Land Trust. And again, it was pretty cool because I was on the board, and a lot of land trusts don't have representation from foresters. But again, by design, me and another forester were right there on the ground floor. And they had, the education built in, but the forester's perspective. And at the time, conservation easements were really evolving from kind of a command and control type of document to more of the working forest model. So that was kind of neat to be part of that. So at that point, I was introduced to the Nature Conservancy, and then a position opened up back in Pennsylvania where I grew up for... at the time, the Nature Conservancy had a Mid-Atlantic division, so I was hired on as their director of forest conservation. And it was kind of the same deal. I had, there was a lot of things that were happening throughout the Nature Conservancy and forestry in the Mid-Atlantic division, but they needed somebody to kind of coordinate that and then liaise between TNC and consulting foresters and forest industry. So out of that work, I ended up the peak of that experience was we developed a program called Working Woodlands that did integrated our FSC certificate with working forest conservation easements, and then attempted to monetize carbon and use carbon revenue for paying for certification and for conservation easements. So we had some limited success, but again, it was kind of this really interesting, you know, blend of all these tools and trying to figure out how to build a better mousetrap. But so I developed this, you know, the more you go through a career, sometimes you kind of start to get kind of niche-y, you know, and that certainly was happening to me. I didn't plan to make a career out of forest carbon, but toward, I guess, about 7 or 8 years into that, at the Nature Conservancy, a company had launched in Philadelphia called Finite Carbon and developing forest carbon offset projects throughout the U.S. So they were looking for somebody who had some of my skill set in terms of outreach and origination and education and certification, and but also understood the carbon markets. And I mean, you know, at the time there's probably one position like that, you know, it just, anyway, it worked out. So that was about 5.5 years ago. It's always interesting to, you know, kind of, you know, look at career paths. I mean, there's no way you would map this thing out, but it's the way it worked out. And it's been really cool to be in academia and then the nonprofit world, and then also in business. It's pretty cool to have that set of experience. So I don't know what's next. I'm happily employed, part owner in this company, but you know, hopefully I still have another 20 years or so in my career, so who knows.
Great, thank you. So let's get to the questions about diversity and inclusion. So this project was developed to understand people's perceptions of diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession. So can you talk about how your ethnicity, cultural background, or gender has influenced your career as a forester? Or alternatively, how your discipline or regional experience has influenced? Yeah. So,
well, I mean, that's not, you know, I'm a white guy, you know, from the East Coast. So, you know, my ethnicity, I mean, I represent, you know, unfortunately, I don't know what the stats are, but 90% of the, you know, plus or minus of the folks that are in the profession. Thankfully, it's changing, and it's changing rapidly. I mean, it's so exciting to be here at SAF this year and have, you know, nearly 600 students. I mean, and a third of the folks that are here, so that's exciting. And there's a lot of women, and I'm seeing more, you know, ethnic diversity as well. So it's good. But my I'm not sure if this is the question that you're asking, but I'm going to go off on it anyway. You know, my sensitivity or awareness to diversity really was kind of oblivious to it. I mean, I noticed it, you know, when I went to Clemson, there was one gal in my class, you know, and you know, it just, I wouldn't say we were, I mean, there was no hostility, it wasn't accessible or known or what. Now, at Clemson, there were some other programs that were, I think, probably a little bit more welcoming or attractive. There's Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management, and that certainly had, you know, more gender and ethnic diversity. But, you know, I just kind of didn't even really pay attention to. When I went to Virginia Tech, there were a lot more gals in the classes, and I don't know. I guess I saw women in leaders of position. Women in positions of leadership, pretty early on in my career. You know, I met, for example, Bettina Ring, who's now the state forester for Virginia, met her early on, and she was the assistant state forester at the time. I can't name any other names, but, you know, it wasn't unusual to see women in positions of leadership. But the ethnic diversity certainly was not there. So I guess you fast forward to, well, at the Nature Conservancy, there was a lot of effort to hire women, not so much on the ethnic diversity side, and we still didn't have it. And I'd say that's still true in the land trust community. When I go, I just came from Raleigh in Minneapolis, and it's still very much a white person's profession. It's changing, and I think it's changing. I'm not sure what's going on, what's causing the change, but I'll tell you, I was at a workshop in Tarrytown, New York recently. It was that Forest Berkeley had sponsored, and it was about the role of land trusts in climate change, which, you know, for obvious reasons, makes sense that I would be there. But in this is going to get kind of wonkish, and I'll try and unpack it. But so our company develops what are called forest carbon offsets. And that's part of that's one of many tools to try and address climate change and mitigate climate change. Not everybody likes carbon offsets because, you know, there are those that would prefer that kind of a command and control type of, you know, install best technologies at the stack, make people clean up the pollution right there, you know. I'm kind of a free market environmental guy, so it's like, wow, this is cool. We've got cap and trade and offsets, and you know this is working. But I was fairly—I had heard about environmental justice and that set of issues, and just because of my background, I was kind of curious. But I really didn't have time to dive into it. And but I'd read up on it a little bit just to try and understand what the issue is, because you know people come at me and say, hey, I really don't like offsets. And well, why is that? You know, well, this issue of environmental justice kept on coming up, and specifically, you know, folks in California—that's the program that we build for. You know, a lot of these factories that are using our product, you know, they're located in disadvantaged communities that have really already paid their environmental debt, and now they're being asked to shoulder even more. And it's interesting, and they tend to be, you know, and this is getting very specific, but I think it's important to point out as kind of a case study. You know, they tend to be Hispanic communities, and if you look at the Hispanic voting record, I mean, they're some of the most environmentally conscious and supportive, you know, of these types of, you know, for parks and green space and, you know, very family oriented and all that. So I don't know if there's a punchline there other than to say, I've just become a lot more aware of environmental justice and you know ethnic issues and how that relates to the environment. I've met some incredible people along the way, folks that are, you know, taking inner city kids, you know, especially like around the time of Ferguson and all that going on, and getting, you know, colored kids out in the woods just for healing. You know, I mean, just to get them. You know, so I mean, really powerful stuff. And it was about that time, you know, our company is growing. We have 9 people now, and this is more of a gender diversity thing, but, you know, we were a bunch of 30 and 40-year-old, you know, white dudes, and I was like, I never pictured myself as the guy that would be, like, the champion of, you know, ethnic and gender diversity for anything, but, you know, I said, listen, guys, you know, we need to branch out here, and, you know, we were hiring 3 folks, and I'm proud to say that we hired our first woman, and it wasn't, you know, it's not an appearance thing. It's, we're a company that's going through, we're growing, we're thriving, but there's a set of perspectives and opinions that are unique to, you know, to genders and ethnicities. And we need that, so we got it. And I'm happy to say, and I think we're a much better company for it.
So. Great. So you've kind of answered the next question on my list, which is, what are your thoughts about diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession? But my follow-up is, do you think the forestry profession is open to new ideas and welcoming to new people?
Yeah, and it, you know, part of it is turnover, and you know, I'm not gonna. It's not so much the. It's a very conservative profession, and a lot of it grew out of, you know, you look at the history. It makes sense that it is what it is, and it's changing to what it's changing to. You know, I mean, a lot of how far back do you want to go? You know, I mean, a lot of forestry started out of you know, wildfire protection, and that was very much you know, sort of a military type of model, and it attracted those types of folks. And you know, I mean, so it's, and the companies that grew out of that eventually, you know, with the IPs and the Weyerhaeusers and, you know, that sort of structure, I mean, it just lent itself to a very, you know, kind of masculine type of workforce, you know. And I hope I'm not saying anything that's offensive. I don't mean to in that way, but I think that culture, you know, just, it was intergenerational and, you know, over multiple decades. But that's starting to wash out, and it's starting to wash out really quickly. And I don't know, you know, what the mega trends are exactly. I travel a lot. I go to a lot of cities. I see a lot of things. You know, it's great to see the, you know, kind of this new urbanization. And I think things like, you know, people are really paying attention to what they eat. You know, where they source their, you know, their food and their clothing and their shelter from. And it's coming full circle now. I mean, I think they're really, you know, more folks, especially younger. I'm encouraged. I love millennials. I mean, I am, because I, you know, I think they really care. I think they care about, you know, who they, their citizenship on the planet. And part of that is understanding, you know, what am I consuming? Where is it coming from? That they don't have a hang up with climate change, is, you know, there is no moral dilemma, you know, as far as, you know, is it real or not? That's not even a question. But there still is a lot of question, unfortunately, in the forestry profession, and it really is, you know, kind of an age and it may be a gender thing, I don't know. So things are changing pretty rapidly, but there is a massive shift going on now. And again, that's why I'm so excited to see 600 students at convention. It's just part of that new wave. Now, I hope we don't lose. I mean, there's a lot of wisdom out there too. You know, with folks that we need to respect. I mean, I guess that's part of what we're doing here today. Anyway, I don't know if that got. I don't even know what question we were answering.
The question was, what does is the forestry profession welcoming to new ideas and people?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's somewhat ironic. I mean, we were some of the first folks to use GIS, right? And I mean, our profession, as much as anybody, has pushed, you know, technologies that are now ubiquitous. I mean, you know, smartphones and, you know, putting all this stuff together, and very innovative and very creative, because we're often underfunded. You know, we don't get a lot of people. It's sort of this, it's this amazing profession that figures things out, you know, and usually with scarce resources. So that makes foresters very creative. That's at least been my experience, and I know a lot of my colleagues. So yeah, I think it's definitely open to change, but at the same time, it's not, you know, because of what I was just, you know, what we were just talking about. But yeah, I mean, as far as innovation and technology, no question. And now the, you know, kind of the issues that we're talking about today with the ethnic and the gender diversity is catching up. And there's been hot spots or pockets of success for a long time. Like I point out, Virginia Tech. I mean, I think that was a school that early on, you know, made a commitment to at least to gender diversity and really, really going after that. The other interesting thing, though, you know, is that, I'm really blessed in this way, is that I spend about a third of my time in Indian country now. So some of our largest clients are Native American communities. And what an eye-opener that's been. I mean, just how much I didn't know. And it's been very humbling to you know, learn about the history and what's been going on. But the, you know, what we've been trying to figure out as a company, we generate a lot of revenue for our clients, and it's for, you know, for the protection and management of their natural resources. And one of the things that we always are trying to encourage but can't force our clients to do is to take some of that revenue and invest it into their youth, specifically with regard to getting them, connecting them back into natural resources. And you know, Adrian Layton's here. I don't know if you know Adrian, but he's at he's the prof at Salish Kootenai College in Montana. And I think they're actually going to do. There's something on the agenda that talks about this, how to get Native American youth into natural resources. But he's at the tip of the spear on that, and we're trying to figure out how to promote that as well. You know, I don't know if we'll actually create a scholarship or what we'll do, but we care about this stuff as a company, and I certainly care about it personally, trying mm-hmm. to figure out I think SAF and the forestry community is welcoming, but I'm not sure that they know really what to do, you know, how to really bring folks in.
Can you say more about how your company is encouraging clients to invest in youth? Maybe just clarifying who your clients typically are and why they would be making investments, how that would work.
Sure. So, our clients are America's private forest landowners, which is a very diverse demographic, as you know. But because of the costs of developing a project and barriers to entry and into the market, we're talking about landowners generally that have 5 or 10,000 acres or more. So, you know, you could broadly that would be like TIMOs and REITs, the land trust community, Native American communities, and then, you know, sort of an oddball mix of corporate, you know, like Norfolk Southern and our own company. Actually, we buy land as well, and some trusts in Appalachia, British Petroleum. They have some land in South Carolina. So those are our clients. As far as encouraging them to, So my job is origination. I'm the guy who's always, you know, doing the presentations and that sort of thing. So it's usually it's been less deliberate, except for in Indian country. I mean, it's more sidebar conversations and my trying to expand my circles into these communities and who I reach out to, looking for reasons to, you know, to not just focus on forest carbon, which again is a really sort of dark corner of niche corner of natural resources. It's just an issue that I bring up more now. I mean, in conversation, it's like, you know, what are you thinking about this? Do you care about it? Are you, you know, how do we deal with it? You know, accepting, you know, an invitation like this. Maybe it's not really deliberate, but now in Indian country, these conversations take place a lot. You know, they're very frequent. Just trying to figure out how do we capitalize on this revenue that's coming into Indian country now to really, you know, catalyze getting Native American youth into natural resources. But my understanding is that's growing. But, you know, again, these communities are pretty disadvantaged. They're not well off economically, and you know, there's a lot of uses for the revenue that we're generating. But as much as any place, I mean, Native American communities are, you know, really deeply grounded in their land, which they've had to fight to keep what little they have left. And they're very family-oriented, you know, so they really do, you know, despite all of the issues that, you know, that are in the broader, you know, culture outside of Indian country, but really tend to get uber concentrated in Indian country with, you know, substance abuse. And it's, yeah, I mean, I don't mean to say that it's that there's a lot of hope in Indian country too, but the issues tend to get really concentrated. So natural resources it's just such a cool potential solution, you know, for a lot of the issues that are going on in Indian country. I mean, to get the youth connected back to the land in a meaningful kind of way, you know, and investing and you know, this idea of, you know, seven generations isn't lip service in Indian country, but there's a surprising amount of disconnect even within, you know, Native American culture and the youth, because they're competing, you know, that they have, you know, video games and, you know, again, substance. I mean, everything that's going on in the broader culture is going on in Indian country, too. So, yeah, I kind of wandered there a little bit, but...
No, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so you've touched on this a little bit, but do you have any thoughts about the role that SAF can play in enhancing diversity and inclusion?
Well, here we are, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, really, though, and I think... I think SAF's doing a really good job, you know, of sponsoring the diversity breakfasts and, you know, the mentorships that are going on. The proof's in the pudding. I mean, a third of the folks that are here are students, and you notice it, and the students are coming up. I mean, they're not bashful. I mean, they want to talk, and that's what I'm saying. I think there's a lot of good stuff happening. So I don't know if there's any anything that SAF isn't doing. I commend SAF for their efforts to, and I think it's working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you see that as particularly new this year or the past few years?
No, but I've known some of the folks that have been on it. I was very active in SAF. In SAF leadership for about 12 years. I haven't been for the last couple, but spent a lot of time in, you know, in D.C. and with staff. I served as the chair of the Certification Review Board and served on the CRB it was 6 years. And I was on the Committee on Forest Policy before that for 3 or 6, I don't remember. But, you know, so I saw the work that was being done, you know, with Michael and Louise and Carol and so I was pretty aware of what was going on.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying this is a longer trend?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's paying dividends.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the profession of forestry going in the next 20 years?
Oh, good grief.
And then 100 years.
Well, the hope springs eternal that the consciousness of the general public and the average American will really, really understand the value of managing our resources. I think that is happening, especially with this the newer generations that are coming up. They think they're just it's a much more informed consumer that's coming up now, in general. I think they just care where their stuff is coming from and the impact of their consumption. I think that's driving it as much as anything. The climate change is real, and you know, unfortunately, folks tend not to pay attention to things until it's in your face. Well, it's starting to get in our face now in places. So I think that'll tend to wake, and the changes are afoot. The resource does have to be managed, and forestry is there. I mean, we're plug and play. You know, we're the solution. You know, I mean, it's so obvious. Folks are realizing it. So in 20 years, I mean, the obvious technology changes. I mean, it's hard to know how much boots on the ground activity will be. I mean, who knows? I see some. The mega trends, forest ownership is going to get really interesting over the next 20 years. I don't know how much longer the TIMO model is going to stick together. Who will be the next, you know, large landowner? I think it's going to be the large integrated international energy companies. I think it's going to be, you know, BP and Chevron and Shell and ExxonMobil are going to end up owning a lot of land at some point. And part of that is driven by, ultimately, I think there's going to be a price on carbon in all places. So as soon as that happens, folks are going to be looking at what's the lowest cost and most efficient solution. You know, we're still going to be consuming fossil fuels for a while. How do these companies that have these emissions, you know, how are they going to best comply? You know, are they going to continue to work with private landowners? Are they going to, and the feedstocks. I mean, everything that you can do with oil, you can do with wood. You know, we were doing it 100 years ago. Why did we stop? Because oil got cheap, you know, and it's expensive to do this. But the technologies are changing so quickly, so there's going to be a lot more pressure on the resource to do a lot more things. But it can handle it, but it has to be managed. The tall building movement is insane. I mean, it's just so cool to see these high rises that are being built out of wood now. You know, I mean, the amount of activity that's been, you know, and awareness that's been going on, it's been slow to get into the U.S., but in other parts of the world, I mean, they're pushing the envelope, doing really cool things, building, you know, 10, 20, 30-story buildings with wood. Yeah. It's just amazing. So, because we can't continue, the carbon footprint of using steel and, you know, using plastics and these other things is just, it's just too high. So to use, it will become more commonplace to use wood for a lot of different things. The way I think we'll come full circle. And then how soon will it be before everybody's, you know, driving a solar powered Tesla? You know, I mean, all that's going to happen in the next 20 years. And, you know, where's forestry going to fit into all that? I'm not really sure, you know. But it's fun to be at the bleeding edge of it. You know, our company developing forest carbon offset projects. I mean, I don't know. In 100 years? Jeez. I mean, 100 years. I just came back from a workshop. I was giving a presentation with Manomet. Center up in Maine, and they do a lot of really cool work. Clients, you know, their clients are our clients, you know, Lime and the Forest Land Group and RMS and Hancock, you know, other forest landowners. But they're kind of an extension way. They take very complex information and put it into news that managers can use. Where am I going with all this? Well, I mean, in 100 years, you can get climate-induced massive shifts in vegetation. I mean, so we don't even know what our forest types are going to look like in 100 years. I mean, things are starting to rearrange themselves on the landscape right now. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. But the next 20 years is going to be really interesting. Yeah.
Well, I'll stop there with the main questions. I just want to finish up with a few demographic questions.
Sure.
Can you tell me what year you were born?
Sure. I'm a child of the 60s, believe it or not, 1969.
Okay.
Yeah, very good year.
And what gender do you identify as?
As male.
And how do you identify your racial, ethnic, or cultural background?
Well, I'm Caucasian. I mean, there's no question about that. Yeah, I mean, but to unpack that, my grandfather came over from Wales, coal miner in Pennsylvania, and my mom's side has been in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, since the 1750s.
Wow.
We were redcoats.
Wow.
We were Hessian soldiers. So, yeah.
And is there anything you'd like to add about forestry or SAF or diversity that we didn't cover?
I just say, you know, the thing that SAF's been good to me, you know, but you get what you put in. I learned a lot of my, you know, such as they are, leadership skills in SAF. I was the Blue Ridge chapter chair, you know, I mean, last person to step back, you know, kind of thing, but I'm very grateful for it. And then I got involved with Appalachian SAF, and then that led to service on the Committee on Forest Policy and the Certification Review Board, and ultimately chaired that. I've served on accreditation teams. You know, it's been great. It's been really good. You know, I don't know that there's anything there specific to, you know, to gender or ethnic diversity, other than I'm just, you know, this is my, forestry is my sandbox, and, you know, these issues are very germane, and, you know, I've got a pretty positive outlook on where the profession is going with regard to those issues. It'll make us stronger. I mean, we all talk about diversity of, you know, return of investment and in your portfolio, and in your forest, and the same thing is true in your human resources. So
great. Well, thank you. I'll stop the recorder now.